wanted him to do. Matachi felt haunted by the thought that he had incurred an obligation. The samurai had come upon him when he was sick and had had the kindness to give him medicine. Why had fate blinded Matahachi when he should have been warning the man of the inspector's approach? Was this destined to have occurred? Matahachi tentatively touched the cloth-wrapped bundle on the dead man's obi. The contents would surely reveal who the man was and where he was from. Matahachi suspected that his dying wish had been to have some memento delivered to his family. He detached the bundle, as well as the pillbox, and stuffed them quickly inside his own kimono. He debated whether to cut off a lock of hair for the man's mother, but while staring into the fearsome face, he heard footsteps approaching. Peeking from behind a rock, he saw samurai coming for the corpse. If he were caught with the dead man's possessions, he'd be in serious trouble. He crouched down low and made his way from shadow to shadow behind the rocks, sneaking away like a field rat. 2 hours later, he arrived at the sweet shop where he was staying. The shopkeeper's wife was by the side of the house, rinsing herself off from a wash basin. Hearing him moving about inside, she showed a portion of her white flesh from behind the side door and called, "Is that you, Matahachi?" Answering with a loud grunt, he dashed into his own room and grabbed a kimono and his sword from a cabinet. He then knotted a rolled towel around his head and prepared to slip into his sandals again. "Isn't it dark in there?" called the woman. "No, I can see well enough." "I'll bring you a lamp." "No need to. I'm going out."
"Aren't you going to wash?"
"No, later." He rushed out into the field and swiftly moved away from the shabby house. A few minutes later, he looked back to see a group of samurai, no doubt from the castle, come from beyond the miscanthus in the field. They entered the sweet shop from both front and rear. "That was a close call," he thought. "Of course, I didn't really steal anything. I just took it in custody. I had to. He begged me to." To his way of thinking, as long as he admitted that the articles were not his, he had committed no crime. At the same time, he realized he could never again show his face at the construction site. The miscanthus came up to his shoulders, and a veil of evening mist floated above it. No one could see him from a distance. It would be easy to get away. But which way to go was a difficult choice, all the more so since he strongly felt that good luck lay in one direction and bad luck in another. Osaka? Kyoto? Nagoya? Edo? He had no friends in any of those places. He might as well roll dice to decide where to go. With dice, as with Matahachi, all was chance. When the wind blew, it would waft him along with it. It seemed to him that the farther he walked, the deeper he went into the miscanthus. Insects buzzed about him, and the descending mist dampened his clothes. The soaked hems curled around his legs, seeds caught at his sleeves. His shins itched. The memory of his noonday nausea was gone now, and he was painfully hungry. Once he felt himself out of the reach of his pursuers, it became agony to walk. An overwhelming urge to find a place to lie down and rest carried him the length of the field, beyond which he spotted the roof of a house. Drawing nearer, he saw that the fence and gate were both askew, apparently damaged by a recent storm. The roof needed fixing, too. Yet at one time, the house must have belonged to a wealthy family, for there was a certain faded elegance about it. He imagined a beautiful court lady seated in a richly curtained carriage approaching the house at a stately pace. Going through the forlorn-looking gate, he found that both the main house and a smaller detached house were nearly buried in weeds. The scene reminded him of a passage by the poet Saigyo that he had been made to learn as a child. "I heard that a person I knew lived in Fushimi and went to pay him a call, but the garden was so overgrown, I couldn't even see the path. As the insects sang,
I compose this poem. Pressing through the weeds, I hide my tearful feelings in the folds of my sleeve. In the dew-laden garden, even lowly insects weep.
Matahachi's heart was chilled as he crouched near the house, whispering the words so long forgotten. Just as he was about to conclude the house was empty, a red light appeared from deep inside. Presently, he heard the pining strains of a shakuhachi, the bamboo flute mendicant priests played when begging on the streets. Looking inside, he discovered the player was indeed a member of that class. He was seated beside the hearth. The fire he had just lit grew brighter, and his shadow loomed larger on the wall. He was playing a mournful tune, a solitary lament on the loneliness and melancholy of autumn, intended for no ears but his own. The man played simply, without flourish, giving Matahachi the impression he took little pride in his playing. When the melody came to an end, the priest sighed deeply and launched into a lament.
"They say when a man is 40, he is free from delusion. But look at me. 47 when I destroyed my family's good name. 47. And still I was deluded. Contrived to lose everything. Income, position, reputation. Not only that, I left my only son to fend for himself in this wretched world. For what? An infatuation? It's mortifying. Never again could I face my dead wife, nor the boy, wherever he is. Ha! When they say you're wise after 40, they must be talking about great men, not dolts like me. Instead of thinking myself wise because of my years, I should have been more careful than ever. It's madness not to, where women are concerned."
Standing his shakuhachi on end in front of him, and propping both hands on the mouthpiece, he went on.
"When that business with Otsu came up, nobody would forgive me any longer. It's too late. Too late."
Matahachi had crept into the next room. He listened, but was repelled by what he saw. The priest's cheeks were sunken, his shoulders had a pointed, stray-dog air, and his hair was sheenless. Matahachi crouched in silence. In the flickering firelight, the man's form summoned up visions of demons of the night.
"Oh, what am I to do?"
moaned the priest, lifting his sunken eyes to the ceiling. His kimono was plain and dingy, but he also wore a black cassock, indicating he was a follower of the Chinese Zen master Pu Hua. The reed matting on which he sat, and which he rolled up and carried with him wherever he went, was probably his only household possession, his bed, his curtain, and in bad weather, his roof.
"Talking won't bring back what I've lost," he said. "Why wasn't I more careful? I thought I understood life. I understood nothing. Let my status go to my head. I behaved shamelessly toward a woman. No wonder the gods deserted me. What could be more humiliating?"
The priest lowered his head as though apologizing to someone, then lowered it still farther.
"I don't care about myself. The life I have now is good enough for me. It's only right I should do penance and have to survive without outside help. But what have I done to Jotaro? He'll suffer more for my misconduct than I. If I were still in Lord Ikeda's service, he'd now be the only son of a samurai with an income of 5,000 bushels. But because of my stupidity, he's nothing. What's worse, one day, when he's grown, he'll learn the truth."
For a time, he sat with his hands covering his face, then suddenly stood up.
"I must stop this. Feeling sorry for myself again. The moon's out. I'll go walk in the field, rid myself of these old grievances and ghosts."
The priest picked up his shakuhachi and shuffled listlessly out of the house. Mataji thought he saw a hint of a stringy mustache under the emaciated nose.
What a strange person, he thought. He's not really old, but he's so unsteady on his feet.
Suspecting the man might be a little insane, he felt a tinge of pity for him. Fanned by the evening breeze, the flames from the broken kindling were beginning to scorch the floor. Entering the empty room, Mataji found a pitcher of water and poured some on the fire, reflecting as he did so on the priest's carelessness. It wouldn't matter much if this old deserted house burned to the ground, but what if instead it were an ancient temple of the Asuka or Kamakura period? Mataji felt a rare spasm of indignation.
It's because of people like him that the ancient temples in Nara and on Mount Koya are destroyed so often, he thought. These crazy vagabond priests have no property, no family of their own. They don't give a thought to how dangerous fire is. They'll light one in the main hall of an old monastery, right next to the murals, just to warm their own carcasses, which are of no use to anyone. Now there's something interesting, he mumbled, turning his eyes toward the alcove.
It wasn't the graceful design of the room, nor the remains of a valuable vase that had attracted his attention, but a blackened metal pot, beside which stood a sake jar with a chipped mouth. In the pot was some rice gruel, and when he shook the jar, it made a cheerful gurgling sound. He smiled broadly, grateful for his good fortune and oblivious, as any hungry man might be, to the property rights of others. He promptly drained off the sake in a couple of long swallows, emptied the rice pot, and congratulated himself on the fullness of his belly. Nodding sleepily beside the hearth, he became conscious of the rain-like buzz of insects coming from the dark field outside, not only from the field, but from the walls, the ceiling, and the rotting tatami mats. Just before drifting off to sleep, he remembered the bundle he had taken from the dying warrior. He roused himself and untied it. The cloth was a soiled piece of crepe dyed with a dark red sappanwood dye. It contained a washed and bleached undergarment, together with the usual articles travelers carry. Unfolding the garment, he found an object the size and shape of a letter scroll, wrapped with great care in oil paper. There was also a purse which fell with a loud clink from a fold in the fabric. Made of purple-dyed leather, it contained enough gold and silver to make Matahachi's hand shake with fear.
"This is someone else's money, not mine," he reminded himself.
Undoing the oil paper around the longer object revealed a scroll, wound on a Chinese quince roller, with a gold brocade end cloth. He immediately sensed that it contained some important secret, and with great curiosity put the scroll down in front of him and slowly unrolled it. It said,
"Certificate.
On sacred oath, I swear that I have transmitted to Sasaki Kojiro the following 7 secret methods of the Chūjō style of swordsmanship. Overt lightning style, wheel style, rounded style, floating boat style, secret, the diamond, the edification, the infinite. Issued in the village of Jōkyōji in the Usaka domain of Echizen province on the blank day of the blank month. Kanemaki Jisai, disciple of Toda Seigen." On a piece of paper that seemed to have been attached later, there followed a poem. "The moon shining on the waters not present, in an undug well, yields forth a man with neither shadow nor form." Mataji realized he was holding a diploma given to a disciple who had learned all his master had to teach, but the name Kanemaki Jisai meant nothing to him. He would have recognized the name of Ito Yagoro, who, under the name Itosai, had created a famous and highly admired style of swordsmanship. He did not know that Jisai was Ito's teacher. Nor did he know that Jisai was a samurai of splendid character, who had mastered the true style of Todasegen and had retired to a remote village to pass his old age in obscurity, thereafter transmitting Seigen's method to only a few select students. Matahachi's eyes went back to the first name.
This Sasaki Kojiro must have been the samurai who was killed at Fushimi today, he thought. He must have been quite a swordsman to be awarded a certificate in the Chujo style, whatever that is. Shame he had to die. But now I'm sure of it. It's just as I suspected. He must have wanted me to deliver this to somebody, probably someone in his birthplace.
Matahachi said a short prayer to the Buddha for Sasaki Kojiro, then vowed to himself that somehow he would carry out his new mission. To ward off the chill, he rebuilt the fire, then lay down by the hearth and presently fell asleep. From somewhere in the distance came the sound of the old priest's shakuhachi. The mournful tune, seemingly searching for something, calling out to someone, went on and on, a poignant wave hovering over the rushes of the field. Reunion in Osaka. The field lay under a gray mist, and the chill in the early morning air hinted that autumn was beginning in earnest. Squirrels were up and about, and in the doorless kitchen of the deserted house, fresh fox tracks crossed the earthen floor. The beggar priest, having stumbled back before sunrise, had succumbed to fatigue on the pantry floor, still clutching his shakuhachi. His dirty kimono and cassock were wet with dew and spotty with grass stains picked up while he wandered like a lost soul through the night. As he opened his eyes and sat up, his nose crinkled, his nostrils and eyes opened wide, and he shook with a mighty sneeze. He made no effort to wipe off the snot trickling from his nose into his wispy mustache. He sat there for a few minutes before recalling that he still had some sake left from the night before. Grumbling to himself, he made his way down a long hallway to the hearth room at the back of the house. By daylight, there were more rooms than there had seemed to be at night, but he found his way without difficulty. To his astonishment, the sake jar was not where he had left it. Instead, there was a stranger by the hearth, with his head on his arm and saliva seeping from his mouth, sound asleep. The whereabouts of the sake was all too clear. The sake, of course, was not all that was missing. A quick check revealed that not a drop of the rice gruel intended for breakfast remained. The priest turned scarlet with rage. He could get by without the sake, but rice was a matter of life and death. With a fierce yelp, he kicked the sleeper with all his might, but Matahachi grunted sleepily, took his arm from underneath him, and lazily raised his head.
You,
sputtered the priest, giving him another kick.
What are you doing?
Cried Matahachi. The veins popped out on his sleepy face as he jumped to his feet.
You can't kick me like that. Kicking's not good enough for you. Who told you you could come in here and steal my rice and sake?
Oh, were they yours?
Of course they were.
Sorry.
You're sorry? What good does that do me?
I apologize.
You'll have to do more than that.
What do you expect me to do?
Give them back.
They're already inside me. They kept me alive for a night.
Can't get them back now. I have to live too, don't I? The most I ever get for going around and playing music at people's gates is a few grains of rice or a couple of drops of sake, you imbecile. Do you expect me to stand silently by and let you steal my food? I want it back. Give it back.
His tone as he made his irrational demand was imperious, and his voice sounded to Matahachi like that of a hungry devil straight from hell.
Don't be so stingy, said Matahachi disparagingly. What's there to get so upset about? A little rice and less than half a jar of third-rate sake. You ass! Maybe you turn your nose up at leftover rice, but for me, it's a day's food, a day's life.
The priest grunted and grabbed Matahachi's wrist.
I won't let you get away with this.
Don't be a fool, countered Matahachi.
Resting his arm free and seizing the old man by his thin hair, he tried to throw him down with a quick yank. To his surprise, the starved cat body didn't budge. The priest got a firm grip on Matahachi's neck and clung to it.
You bastard!
Barked Matahachi, reassessing his opponent's fighting power. He was too late. The priest, planting his feet solidly on the floor, sent Matahachi stumbling backward with a single push. It was a skillful move, utilizing Matahachi's own strength, and Matahachi did not stop until he banged against a plastered wall on the far side of the adjacent room. The posts and lathing being rotten, a good part of the wall collapsed, showering him with dirt. Spitting out a mouthful, he jumped up, drew his sword, and lunged at the old man. The latter prepared to parry the attack with his shakuhachi, but he was already gasping for air.
"Now see what you've got yourself into!"
yelled Matahachi as he swung. He missed, but went on swinging relentlessly, giving the priest no chance to catch his breath. The old man's face took on a ghostly look. He jumped back time and again, but there was no spring in his step. He appeared to be on the verge of collapse. Each time he dodged, he let out a plaintive cry, like the whimper of a dying man. Still, his constant shifting made it impossible for Matahachi to connect with his sword. Eventually, Matahachi was undone by his own carelessness. When the priest jumped into the garden, Matahachi followed blindly, but the moment his foot hit the rotted floor of the veranda, the boards cracked and gave way. He landed on his backside, one leg dangling through a hole. The priest leaped to the attack. Grabbing the front of Matahachi's kimono, he started beating him on the head, the temples, the body, anywhere his shakuhachi happened to fall, grunting loudly with each whack. With his leg caught, Matahachi was helpless. His head seemed ready to swell to the size of a barrel, but luck was with him, for at this point, pieces of gold and silver began dropping from his kimono. Each new blow was followed by the happy tinkling of coins falling on the floor.
"What's this?"
gasped the priest, letting go of his victim. Matahachi hastily freed his leg and jumped clear, but the old man had already vented his anger. His aching fist and labored breathing didn't stop him from staring in wonder at the money. Matahachi, hands on his throbbing head, shouted,
"See, you old fool? There was no reason to get excited over a little bit of rice and sake. I've got money to throw away. Take it if you want it. But in return, you're going to get back the beating you gave me. Stick out your silly head, and I'll pay you with interest for your rice and booze."
Instead of responding to this abuse, the priest put his face to the floor and began weeping. Matahachi's wrath abated somewhat, but he said venomously,
"Look at you. The minute you see money, you fall apart."
"How shameful of me," wailed the priest. "Why am I such a fool?"
Like the strength with which he had so lately fought, his self-reproach was more violent than that of an ordinary man.
"What an ass I am,"
he continued.
"Haven't I come to my senses yet? Not even at my age? Not even after being cast out of society and sinking as low as a man can sink?"
He turned toward the black column beside him and started beating his head against it, all the time moaning to himself,
"Why do I play this shakuhachi? Isn't it to expel through its five openings my delusions, my stupidity, my lust, my selfishness, my evil passions? How could I possibly have allowed myself to get into a life-and-death struggle over a bit of food and drink, and with a man young enough to be my son?"
Matahachi had never seen anyone like this. The old man would weep for a moment, then ram his head against the column again. He seemed intent on beating his forehead until it split in two. More numerous by far were his inflictions on himself than the blows he had dealt Matahachi. Presently,
Blood began to flow from his brow. Matahachi felt obliged to prevent him from torturing himself further.
"Look now," he said. "Stop that. You don't know what you're doing." "Leave me alone," pleaded the priest.
"But what's wrong with you?"
"Nothing's wrong."
"There must be something. Are you sick?"
"No."
"Then what is it?"
"I'm disgusted with myself. I'd like to beat this evil body of mine to death and feed it to the crows, but I don't want to die a stupid fool. I'd like to be as strong and upright as the next person before I discard this flesh. Losing my self-control makes me furious. I guess you could call it sickness after all."
Feeling sorry for him, Matahachi picked up the fallen money and tried to press some of it into his hand.
"It was partly my fault," he said apologetically. "I'll give you this, and then maybe you'll forgive me." "I don't want it," cried the priest, quickly withdrawing his hand. "I don't need money. I tell you, I don't need it."
Though he had previously exploded in anger over a bit of rice gruel, he now looked at the money with loathing. Shaking his head vigorously, he backed away, still on his knees.
"You're an odd one," said Matahachi.
"Not really."
"Well, you certainly act strange. Don't let it worry you."
"You sound like you come from the western provinces, your accent, I mean."
"I guess I would. I was born in Himeji."
"Is that so? I'm from that area too, Mimasaka."
"Mimasaka?"
repeated the priest, fixing his eye on Matahachi.
"Just where in Mimasaka?"
"The village of Yoshino, Miyamoto to be exact."
The old man seemed to relax. Sitting down on the porch, he spoke quietly.
"Miyamoto. That's a name that brings back memories. I was once on guard duty at the stockade in Hinagura. I know that area fairly well."
"Does that mean you used to be a samurai in the Himeji fief?"
"Yes. I suppose I don't look it now, but I used to be something of a warrior. My name is Aoki Tang..."
He broke off, then just as abruptly went on.
"That's not true. I just made it up. Forget I said anything at all."
He stood up, saying,
"I'm going into town, play my shakuhachi and get some rice."
With that, he turned and walked rapidly toward the field of miscanthus. After he was gone, Matahachi started wondering whether it had been right of him to offer the old priest money from the dead samurai's pouch. Soon, he'd solved his dilemma by telling himself there couldn't be any harm in just borrowing some, provided it wasn't a lot.
"If I deliver these things to the dead man's home the way he wanted me to," he thought, "I'll have to have money for expenses, and what choice do I have but to take it out of the cash I have here?"
This easy rationalization was so comforting that from that day on, he began using the money little by little. There remained the question of the certificate made out to Sasaki Kojiro. The man appeared to have been a ronin, but mightn't he instead have been in the service of some daimyo? Matachi had found no clue to where the man was from, hence had no idea where to take the certificate. His only hope, he decided, would be to locate the master swordsman Kanemaki Jisai, who no doubt knew all there was to know about Sasaki. As Matahachi made his way from Fushimi toward Osaka, he asked at every tea house, eating house, and inn, whether anyone knew of Jisai. All the replies were negative. Even the added information that Jisai was an accredited disciple of Toda Seigen elicited no response. Finally, a samurai with whom Matahachi struck up an acquaintance on the road displayed a glimmer of recognition.
"I've heard of Jisai, but if he's still alive, he must be very old. Somebody said he went east and became a recluse in a village in Kozuke or somewhere. If you want to find out more about him, you should go to Osaka Castle and talk to a man named Tomita Mondonosho."
Mondonosho, it seemed, was one of Hideyori's teachers in the martial arts, and Matahachi's informant was fairly sure he belonged to the same family as Seigen. Though disappointed at the vagueness of his first real lead, Matahachi resolved to follow it up. Upon his arrival in Osaka, he took a room at a cheap inn on one of the busier streets, and as soon as he was settled in, asked the innkeeper whether he knew of a man named Tomita Mondonosho at Osaka Castle.
"Yes, I've heard the name," replied the innkeeper. "I believe he's the grandson of Toda Seigen. He's not Lord Hideyori's personal instructor, but he does teach swordsmanship to some of the samurai in the castle. Or, at least he used to. I think he might have gone back to Echizen some years ago. Yes, that's what he did. You could go to Echizen and look for him, but there's no guarantee he's still there. Instead of taking such a long trip on a hunch, wouldn't it be easier to look up Ito Itosai? I'm pretty sure he studied the Chūjō style under Jisai before developing his own style." The innkeeper's suggestion seemed sensible, but when Matahachi began looking for Itosai, he found himself in another blind alley. As far as he could learn, the man had until recently been living in a small hut in Shirakawa, just east of Kyoto, but he was no longer there and hadn't been seen in Kyoto or Osaka for some time. Before long, Matahachi's resolution flagged, and he was ready to drop the whole business. The bustle and excitement of the city rekindled his ambition and stirred his youthful soul. In a wide open town like this, why should he spend his time looking for a dead man's family? There were plenty of things to do here. People were looking for young men like him. At Fushimi Castle, the authorities had been single-mindedly implementing the policies of the Tokugawa government. Here, however, the generals running Osaka Castle were searching out Ronin to build up an army. Not publicly, of course, but openly enough so that it was common knowledge. It was a fact that Ronin were more welcome and could live better here than in any other castle town in the country. Heady rumors circulated among the townspeople. It was said, for instance, that Hideyori was quietly providing funds for such fugitive daimyo as Goto Matabe, Sanada Yukimura, Akashi Kamon, and even the dangerous Chosokabe Morichika, who now lived in a rented house in a narrow street on the outskirts of town. Chosokabe had, despite his youth, shaved his head like a Buddhist priest and changed his name to Ichimusai, the man of a single dream. It was a declaration that the affairs of this floating world no longer concerned him, and ostensibly he passed his time in elegant frivolities. It was widely known, however, that he had in his service 700 or 800 ronin, all of them firm in their confidence that when the proper time came, he would rise up and vindicate his late benefactor Hideyoshi. It was rumored that his living expenses, including the pay for his ronin, all came from Hideyori's private purse. For 2 months, Matahachi wandered about Osaka, increasingly confident that this was the place for him. Here was where he would catch the straw that would lead to success. For the first time in years, he felt as brave and dauntless as when he'd gone off to war. He was healthy and alive again, unperturbed by the gradual depletion of the dead samurai's money, for he believed luck was finally turning his way. Every day was a joy, a delight. He was sure he was about to stumble over a rock and come up covered with money. Good fortune was on the verge of finding him. New clothes! That was what he needed. And so he bought himself a complete new outfit, carefully choosing material that would be suitable in the cold of approaching winter. Then, having decided living in an inn was too expensive, he rented a small room belonging to a saddle maker in the vicinity of the Junkei Moat and began taking his meals out. He went to see what he wanted to see, came home when he felt like it, and stayed out all night from time to time as the spirit moved him. While basking in his happy-go-lucky existence, he remained on the lookout for a friend,
a connection who would lead him to a good-paying position in the service of a great daimyo. It required a certain amount of self-restraint for Matahachi to live within his means, but he felt he was behaving himself better than ever before. He was repeatedly buoyed up by stories of how this or that samurai had not long ago been hauling dirt away from a construction site, but was now to be seen riding pompously through town with 20 retainers and a spare horse. At other times, he felt a trace of dejection. "The world's a stone wall," he would think, "and they've put the rocks so close together there's not a chink where anybody can get in." But this frustration always eddied away. "What am I talking about? It just looks that way when you still haven't seen your chance. It's always difficult to break in, but once I find an opening..." When he asked the saddle maker whether he knew of a position, the latter replied optimistically, "You're young and strong. If you apply at the castle, they're sure to find a place for you." But finding the right work was not as easy as that. The last month of the year found Matahachi still unemployed, his money diminished by half. Under the wintry sun of the busiest month of the year, the hordes of people milling about the streets looked surprisingly unrushed. In the center of town, there were empty lots, where in early morning the grass was white with frost. As the day progressed, the streets became muddy, and the feeling of winter was driven away by the sound of merchants hawking their goods with clanging gongs and booming drums. 7 or 8 stalls, surrounded by shabby straw matting to keep outsiders from looking in, beckoned with paper flags and lances decorated with feathers to advertise shows being presented inside. Barkers competed stridently to lure idle passers-by into their flimsy theaters. The smell of cheap soy sauce permeated the air. In the shops, hairy-legged men, skewers of food stuffed in their mouths, whinnied like horses, and at twilight, long-sleeved women with whitened faces simpered like ewes, walking together in flocks and munching on parched bean tidbits. One evening, a fight broke out among the customers of a man who had set up a sake shop by placing some stools on the side of the street. Before anyone could tell who had won, the combatants turned tail and ran off down the street, leaving a trail of dripping blood behind them. "Thank you, sir," said the sake vendor to Matahachi, whose glaring presence had caused the fighting townsmen to flee. "If you hadn't been here, they would have broken all my dishes." The man bowed several times, then served Matahachi another jar of sake, which he said he trusted was warmed to just the right temperature. He also presented some snacks as a token of his appreciation. Matahachi was pleased with himself. The brawl had erupted between 2 workmen, and when he had scowled at them, threatening to kill them both if they did any damage to the stall, they had fled. "Lots of people around, aren't there?" he remarked amiably. "It's the end of the year. They stay a while and move on, but others keep coming." "Nice that the weather's holding up." Matahachi's face was red from drink. As he lifted his cup, he remembered having sworn off before he went to work at Fushimi and vaguely wondered how he had started again. "Well, what of it?" he thought. "If a man can't have a drink now and then..." "Bring me another, old boy," he said aloud. The man sitting quietly on the stool next to Matahachi's was also a ronin. His long and short swords were impressive. Townsmen would be inclined to steer clear of him, even though he wore no cloak over his kimono, which was quite dirty around the neck. "Hey, bring me another one too, and make it quick," he shouted. Propping his right leg on his left knee, he scrutinized Matahachi from the feet up. When his eyes came to the face, he smiled and said, "Hello." "Hello," said Matahachi. "Have a sip of mine while yours is being heated." "Thanks," said the man, holding out his cup. "It's humiliating to be a drinker, isn't it? I saw you sitting here with your sake, and then this nice aroma floated through the air and pulled me over here. By the sleeve, sort of." He drained his cup in one gulp. Matahachi liked his style. He seemed friendly, and there was something dashing about him. He could drink, too. He put down 5 jars in the next few minutes, while Matahachi was taking his time over 1. Yet he was still sober.
"How much do you usually drink?" asked Matahachi.
"Oh, I don't know," replied the man offhandedly. 10 or 12 jars when I feel like it." They fell to talking about the political situation, and after a time the ronin straightened up his shoulders and said, "Who's Ieyasu anyway? What kind of nonsense is it for him to ignore Hideyori's claims and go around calling himself the Great Overlord? Without Honda Masazumi and some of his other old supporters, what have you got? Cold-bloodedness, foxiness, and a little political ability. I mean, all he has is a certain flair for politics that you usually don't find in military men. Personally, I wish Ishida Mitsunari had won at Sekigahara, but he was too high-minded to organize the daimyo, and his status wasn't high enough." Having delivered himself of this appraisal, he suddenly asked, "If Osaka were to clash with Edo again, which side would you be on?" Not without hesitation, Matahachi replied, "Osaka."
"Good."
The man stood up with his sake jar in his hand.
"You're one of us. Let's drink to that. What fief do you... Oh, I guess I shouldn't ask that until I tell you who I am. My name is Akakabe Yasoma. I'm from Gamo. Perhaps you've heard of Ban Danemon. I'm a good friend of his. We'll be together again one of these days. I'm also a friend of Susukida Hayato Kanesuke, the distinguished general at Osaka Castle. We traveled together when he was still a ronin. I've also met Ono Shurinosuke 3 or 4 times, but he's too gloomy for me, even if he does have more political influence than Kanesuke."
He stepped back, paused for a moment, seemingly having second thoughts about talking too much, then asked, "Who are you?" Matahachi, though he did not believe everything the man had said, felt somehow that he had been put up temporarily in the shade.
"Do you know of Toda Seigen?" he asked. "The man who originated the Tomita style?"
"I've heard the name."
"Well, my teacher was the great and selfless hermit Kanemaki Jisai, who received the true Tomita style from Seigen and then developed the Chūjō style."
"Then you must be a real swordsman."
"That's right," replied Matahachi.
He was beginning to enjoy the game.
"You know," said Yasoma, "I've been thinking that's what you must be. Your body looks disciplined, and there's an air of capability about you. What were you called when you were training under Jisai? I mean, if I'm not being too bold in asking."
"My name is Sasaki Kojiro," said Matahachi with a straight face. "Ito Yagoro, the creator of the Ito style, is a senior disciple from the same school."
"Is that a fact?"
said Yasoma with astonishment. For a jittery moment, Matahachi thought of retracting everything, but it was too late. Yasomo had already knelt on the ground and was making a deep bow. There was no turning back.
"Forgive me," he said several times. "I've often heard Sasaki Kojiro was a splendid swordsman, and I must apologize for not having spoken more politely. I had no way of knowing who you were."
Matahachi was vastly relieved. If Yasoma had happened to be a friend or acquaintance of Kojiro, he would have had to fight for his life.
"You needn't bow like that,"
said Matahachi magnanimously.
"If you insist on standing on formalities, we won't be able to talk as friends." "But you must have been annoyed by my spouting off so."
"Why?
I have no particular status or position. I'm only a young man who doesn't know much about the ways of the world." "Yes, but you're a great swordsman. I've heard your name many times. Now that I think about it, I can see you must be Sasaki Kojiro."
He stared intently at Matahachi.
"What's more, I don't think it's right that you should have no official position."
Matahachi replied innocently,
Well, I've devoted myself so single-mindedly to my sword that I haven't had time to make many friends.
I see. Does that mean you aren't interested in finding a good position?
No, I've always thought that one day I'd have to find a lord to serve. I just haven't reached that point yet.
Well, it should be simple enough. You have your reputation with the sword to back you up, and that makes all the difference in the world. Of course, if you remain silent, then no matter how much talent you have, nobody's likely to search you out. Look at me. I didn't even know who you were until you told me. I was completely taken by surprise.
Yasuma paused, then said,
If you'd like me to help you, I'd be glad to. To tell the truth, I've asked my friend Susukida Kanesuke to see whether he can find a position for me too. I'd like to be taken on at Osaka Castle, even though there might not be much pay in it. I'm sure Kanesuke would be happy to recommend a person like you to the powers that be. If you'd like, I'll be glad to speak to him.
As Yasuma waxed enthusiastic about the prospect, Matahachi could not avoid the feeling that he had stumbled straight into something it wouldn't be easy to get out of. Eager as he was to find work, he feared he'd made a mistake passing himself off as Sasaki Kojiro. On the other hand, if he had said he was Honiden Matahachi, a country samurai from Mimasaka, Yasuma would never have offered his help. Indeed, he probably would have looked down his nose at him. There was no getting around it. The name Sasaki Kojiro had certainly made a strong impression. But then, was there actually anything to worry about? The real Kojiro was dead, and Matahachi was the only person who knew that, for he had the certificate, the dead man's only identification. Without it, there was no way for the authorities to know who the Ronin was. It was extremely unlikely they would have gone to the trouble of conducting an investigation. After all, who was the man but a spy who had been stoned to death? Gradually, as Matahachi convinced himself that his secret would never be discovered, a bold scheme took definite shape in his mind. He would become Sasaki Kojiro, as of this moment. "Bring the bell," he called, taking some coins from his money pouch. As Matahachi rose to leave, Yasuma, thrown into confusion, blurted,
"What about my proposal?"
"Oh," replied Matahachi, "I'd be very grateful if you'd speak to your friend on my behalf, but we can't discuss this sort of thing here. Let's go somewhere quiet where we can have some privacy."
"Why, of course," said Yasuma, obviously relieved.
He appeared to think it only natural that Matahachi paid his bill, too. Soon, they were in a district some distance from the main streets. Matahachi had intended to take his newfound friend to an elegant drinking establishment, but Yasuma pointed out that going to such a place would be a waste of money. He suggested someplace cheaper and more interesting, and while singing the praises of the red-light district, led Matahachi to what was euphemistically called the Town of Priestesses. Here, it was said, with only slight exaggeration, there were 1,000 houses of pleasure, and a trade so thriving that 100 barrels of lamp oil were consumed in a single night. Matahachi was a little reluctant at first, but soon found himself attracted by the gaiety of the atmosphere. Nearby was an offshoot of the castle moat, into which tidewater flowed from the bay. If one looked very closely, one could discern fish lice and river crabs crawling about under the projecting windows and red lanterns. Matahachi did look closely, and ended up slightly unsettled, for they reminded him of deadly scorpions. The district was peopled to a large extent by women with thickly powdered faces. Among them, a pretty face was to be seen now and then, but there were many others who seemed to be more than 40, women stalking the streets with sad eyes, heads wrapped in cloth to fend off the cold, teeth blackened, but trying vainly to stir the hearts of the men who gathered here.
"There sure are lots of them," said Matahachi with a sigh.
I told you so,
replied Yasuma, who was at pains to make excuses for the women.
And they're better than the next tea-house waitress or singing girl you might take up with. People tend to be put off by the idea of selling sex, but if you spend a winter's night with one of them and talk with her about her family and so on, you're likely to find she's just like any other woman, and not really to blame for having become a whore. Some were once concubines of the shogun, and there are lots whose fathers were once retainers of some daimyo who have since lost power. It was the same centuries ago when the Taira fell to the Minamoto. You'll find, my friend, that in the gutters of this floating world, much of the trash consists of fallen flowers. They went into a house, and Matahachi left everything to Yasuma, who seemed to be quite experienced. He knew how to order the sake, how to deal with the girls. He was flawless. Matahachi found the experience quite entertaining. They spent the night, and even at noon on the next day, Yasuma showed no sign of tiring. Matahachi felt recompensed to some extent for all those times he had been pushed off into a back room at the Yomogi, but he was beginning to run down. Finally, admitting he'd had enough, he said, "I don't want any more to drink. Let's go." Yasuma did not budge. "Stay with me until evening," he said.
"What happens then?"
"I have an appointment to see Susukida Kanesuke. It's too early to go to his house now, and anyway, I won't be able to discuss your situation until I have a better idea of what you want."
"I guess I shouldn't ask for too large an allowance at first."
"There's no point in selling yourself cheap. A samurai of your caliber should be able to command any figure he names. If you say you'll settle for any old position, you'll be demeaning yourself. Why don't I tell him you want an allowance of 2,500 bushels? A samurai with self-confidence is always better paid and treated. You shouldn't give the impression you'd be satisfied with just anything."
As evening approached, the streets in this area, lying as they did in the immense shadow of Osaka Castle, darkened early. Having left the brothel, Matahachi and Yasuma made their way through the town to one of the more exclusive samurai residential areas. They stood with their backs to the moat, the cold wind driving away the effects of the sake they'd been pouring into themselves all day.
"That's Susukida's house there," said Yasuma.
"The one with the bracketed roof over the gate?"
"No, the corner house next to it."
Big, isn't it?"
"Kanisuke's made a name for himself. Until he was 30 or so, nobody had ever heard of him. But now..."
Matahachi pretended to pay no attention to what Yasuma was saying. Not that he did not believe it. On the contrary, he had come to trust Yasuma so thoroughly that he no longer questioned what the man said. He felt, however, that he should remain nonchalant. As he gazed at the mansions of the daimyo which ring the great castle, his still youthful ambition told him,
"I'll live in a place like that too, one of these days."
"Now," said Yasuma, "I'll see Kanesuke and talk him into hiring you, but before that, what about the money?"
"Oh, sure," said Matahachi,
aware that a bribe was in order. Taking the money pouch from his breast, he realized that it had shrunk to about a third of its original bulk. Pouring it all out in his hand, he said,
"This is all I have. Is it enough?"
"Oh, sure. Quite enough."
"You'll want to wrap it up in something, won't you?"
"No, no. Kanesuke's not the only man around here who takes a fee for finding somebody a position. They all do it, and very openly. There's nothing to be embarrassed about."
Matachi kept back a little of the cash, but after handing over the rest, began to feel uneasy. When Yasuma walked away, he followed for a few steps.
"Do the best you can," he implored.
"Don't worry. If it looks as though he's going to be difficult, all I have to do is keep the money and return it to you. He's not the only influential man in Osaka. I could just as easily ask help from Ono or Goto. I've got lots of contacts."
"When will I get an answer?"
"Let's see. You could wait for me, but you wouldn't want to stand here in this wind, would you? Anyway, people might suspect you were up to no good. Let's meet again tomorrow.
Where?
Come to that vacant lot where they're holding sideshows.
All right.
The surest way would be for you to wait at that sake vendor's where we first met.
After they settled on the time, Yasuma waved his hand and walked grandly through the gate to the mansion, swinging his shoulders and showing not the slightest hesitation. Matahachi, duly impressed, felt Yasuma must indeed have known Kanesuke since his less prosperous days. Confidence swept over him, and that night he dreamed pleasant dreams of his future. At the appointed time, Matahachi was walking through the melting frost on the open lot. As on the previous day, the wind was cold, and there were a lot of people about. He waited until sundown, but saw no sign of Akakabe Yasuma. The day after that, Matahachi went again. Something must have detained him, he thought charitably, as he sat staring at the faces of the passing crowd. He'll show up today. But again, the sun set without Yasuma's appearing. On the third day, Matahachi said to the sake vendor, somewhat timidly,
I'm here again.
Are you waiting for someone?
Yes. I'm supposed to meet a man named Akakabe Yasuma. I met him here the other day.
Matahachi went on to explain the situation in detail.
That scoundrel? Gasped the sake vendor. Do you mean he told you he'd find you a good position and then stole your money?
He didn't steal it. I gave him some money to give to a man named Susukida Kanesuke. I'm waiting here to find out what happened.
You poor man! You can wait 100 years, but I dare say you won't see him again.
What? Why do you say that?
Why, he's a notorious crook. This area's full of parasites like him. If they see anybody who looks a little innocent, they pounce on him. I thought of warning you, but I didn't want to interfere. I thought you'd know from the way he looked and acted what sort of character he was. Now you've gone and lost your money. Too bad.
The man was all sympathy. He tried to assure Matahachi that it was no disgrace to be taken in by the thieves operating here. But it wasn't embarrassment that troubled Matahachi. It was finding his money gone, and with it his high hopes that made his blood boil. He stared helplessly at the crowd moving about them.
I doubt it'll do any good, said the sake vendor, but you might try asking over there at the magician's stall. The local vermin often gather behind there to gamble. If Yasuma came by some money, he may be trying to build it into something bigger.
Thanks, said Matahachi, jumping up excitedly. Which is the magician's stall?
The enclosure to which the man pointed was surrounded by a fence of pointed bamboo stakes. Out in front, barkers were drumming up trade, and flags suspended near the wooden gate announced the names of several famous sleight-of-hand artists. From within the curtains and strips of straw matting lining the fence came the sound of strange music, mingled with the loud, rapid patter of the performers and the applause of the audience. Going around to the rear, Matahachi found another gate. When he glanced in, a lookout asked,
"You here to gamble?"
He nodded, and the man let him in. He found himself in a space surrounded by tenting but open to the sky. About 20 men, all unsavory types, sat in a circle playing a game. All eyes turned toward Matahachi, and one man silently made room for him to sit down.
"Is Akakabe Yasuma here?" Matahachi asked.
"Yasuma?" repeated one gambler in a puzzled tone. "Come to think of it, he hasn't been around lately. Why?"
"Do you think he'll come later?"
"How should I know? Sit down and play."
"I didn't come to play."
"What are you doing here if you don't want to play?"
"I'm looking for Yasuma. Sorry to bother you."
"Well, why don't you go look somewhere else?"
"I said I'm sorry," said Matahachi, exiting hastily.
Hold on there, commanded one of the gamblers, getting up and following him. You can't get away with just saying you're sorry. Even if you don't play, you'll pay for your seat.
I don't have any money.
No money?